This is Barbara Leslie, President of the Oakland Port Commission. Oakland International Airport, OAK, is proud to bring you this podcast of KQED's Forum. When you're choosing your next adventure, the smart and convenient choice is to fly the East Bay Way from OAK to destinations across the USA and Mexico. And when you return home, tune in to KQED, always bringing us remarkable stories about who we are and where we live. Enjoy today's episode of Forum.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED. From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Grace Wan, in for Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, Connie Wang never intended to write a book about her mother. It felt almost too cliched, the first-generation immigrant writing about her parents' sacrifice. But in her new memoir, Oh My Mother, Wang documents the travel she has taken with her mom, from Vegas to Versailles, and places in between. Along the way, Wang shares lessons learned from her mother, like why two creme brulees comprise the perfect meal, and how Magic Mike XXL might be the perfect movie. Wang joins us next, after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Grace Wan, in today for Mina Kim. In Chinese, the phrase, oh my God, literally translates to, oh my mother. This bit of translation serendipity perhaps highlights the larger-than-life role mothers play in Chinese culture. And oh my mother turned out to be the perfect title for journalist Connie Wang's new memoir about her own larger-than-life mom, Ching Li. It's never easy to capture a parent on the page, but Wang had help. Her mother was the book's first reader and edited every page, which tells you a little bit about Wang's mom. But rather than me explaining it to you, Connie Wang joins us this morning to talk about her new book, which is at turns poignant and hilarious. Welcome to Forum, Connie.
Thanks for having me. It's so good to be here.
Well, I have given this big buildup to your mom, and I have so many questions about her and your adventures and misadventures with her. But I think many listeners may have first encountered your mom in a recent piece you wrote for the New York Times. And that article, which was titled Generation Connie, centers around your name. And so Connie isn't your original first name. Can you tell us about the name your grandfather chose for you? What was it?
Yeah. Yes, for sure. So my full name in Chinese is Wang Xiaokang. And Xiaokang is a shortened phrase that was fairly popular during the year I was born as a slogan for the Chinese Communist Party, which the meaning of it is basically a bit of prosperity, a medium-sized prosperity for all is better than a large amount of prosperity for a few, which kind of sums it up. And I think that when I was born, he saw me as a small package of prosperity, right? And so it was a pretty direct translation. And that was the name I came to the United States with. And the English spelling of Xiaokang starts with an X, which it makes a lot of sense for the pinyin in Chinese, but people in Nebraska had quite a tough time with it.
Well, your moderate prosperity as your name is just pretty funny. And then when you came when you were 3 years old, and your parents let you choose an American name. And what did you choose?
That's right. They let me choose a English name when we were we made the decision to stay in the United States. I'm so thankful that they helped guide me to a good name. And of course, I don't remember this. But the only English names I really knew were the ones I had encountered in my daycare program, which was through Head Start, and then the names that I had heard on the television. And that's how I learned English, through TV. And that's how my parents learned colloquial English as well. So, it could have been Michelangelo from the Ninja Turtles. Could have been Elmo, but I chose Connie after Connie Chung. She was a beautiful person on TV, and I watched her with my entire family every single evening. So I've heard, and she was she was quite frankly the only person on TV that I saw that looked like the beautiful Ayes that my mom were friends with, but she was famous. So I was like, Connie, right. What about that one? And it sounds awfully a lot similar to Xiao Kong, my Chinese name. So it's a great fit all around.
And growing up, I mean, you grew up largely in Minnesota and stops in Alabama before that. You thought your name was pretty unique, that there were not a lot of Connies around. When did that change for you?
Yeah. So growing up in the middle of the country, I think the only times I ever heard that someone else was named Connie or that name had been part of someone's life was like an aunt, you know, an older woman named Connie who was born in maybe like the 40s or 50s. And that was probably because I didn't grow up among a lot of Asian Americans who had a very similar story to my own. And it wasn't until I went to college at UC Berkeley in California, and finally, for the first time, I was part of a majority. At the time, it was, I think the Asian student body was about 50%, like very close to 50% of the student body at Berkeley. And that was quite the culture shock for me. Mm-hmm. But when I was standing in line during orientation, someone had called out like, Connie Wayne. And I was shocked. I didn't know a single person on campus. I'm like, I have a friend here. Someone knows who I am. But of course, they weren't talking about me. They were shouting at another Connie Wayne who was standing right in front of me in line. That was crazy, you know. Right. And I went home and I logged onto Facebook, which was very new at the time, and I looked up Connie's on campus, and there were so many of us, and they were all Asian. I couldn't believe it. At the time, I think I set up a Connie's Unite Facebook group just for us. And there were a lot of us in that group, I gotta say. And so that was the first clue I had that I was not alone.
Well, was that a good feeling to not be alone? Or was it a bit of a shock to find that there wasn't a lot of originality here in first names, and there are a lot of Connie's?
There are a lot of Connie's, I know. I wouldn't say it was a bad feeling, but it was a surreal feeling to realize that your story is not quite unique. But mm-hmm. I thought it was just like a quirky thing that had happened, right? It was like a bizarre circumstance or a bizarre coincidence. But it wasn't until I started talking to all of these Connie's and asking them, oh, what's the origin of your name? Are you mm-hmm. named after like an aunt, or mm-hmm. is it short for Constance? Mm-hmm. And every single one of them said, no, it's you wouldn't believe it. It's after Connie Chung. I was like, whoa. Oh, of course.
What did Connie Chung represent for you? And I mean, in your piece, you talk about how you didn't think it was a coincidence that all these Connies that you spoke to, because you brought everybody together for the New York Times piece that you wrote, that they had a similar origin story.
That's right. So, you know, the thing that ties all the Asian Connies together is the fact that we're all immigrants, whether we came from another other country, mostly East Asian countries, to the mm-hmm. United States around the same time. That time is when Connie Chung was on air, mm-hmm. Or our parents had come and we were newly born in the United States. And there was something that also ties us together in that, like, our moms mostly had careers back in their home countries that didn't translate in America. So whether it was language-based or it was a skill that was very specific to their home countries, they basically had to reinvent themselves as professionals or abandon that that career once they got to the United States. And there, that sense of loss was understandably like so profound for a lot of people that when they were naming their daughters, you know, and then they were looking around them for any sort of clue as to what is a name that feels appropriate, what is a name that would be welcome, what is a name that is also a strong name and a beautiful name? There was like a face telling them what that name was. And that face was in their living rooms every single evening in the form of Connie Chung. And not only was she very defiantly Asian, she was also beautiful. And she was also so strong. And she asked really, really tough questions to very important people. And she was so brave to be able to do it. And, you know, I don't think that any of our parents were media nerds in the sense mm-hmm. that, you know, some of us Connies are media nerds now. They probably didn't understand the sort of like palace intrigue and politics of Connie Chung being on the air, right. And what that meant at the time. But the simple fact that she was there meant a lot. And for women in their 20s and 30s who thought about their careers and thought about their sense of place in this world really seriously, mm-hmm. they saw Connie Chung as a real world model.
Well, I grew up in Southern California when she was a local broadcaster for a little bit, and I loved her too. And you met her, right? She came to the New York Times studios to meet the other Connies, but you've spoken to her, and I think she even did a blurb for your book.
She did, Grace. But you know what? The funny thing is, I've never actually met her. Oh. I've only spoken with her on the phone, and I've been so lucky to have spoken with her a few times. The first time I actually reached out to her as I was doing research into the memoir I wrote, and that was, I can't believe she responded to my email, and then we hopped on the phone. It was a lovely conversation. But when the New York Times organized this photo shoot, unfortunately, I couldn't make it out there. But I'm so happy that Connie Chung got the chance to meet all these other Connies and kind of see her legacy in living form, you know? And I wish I could have been there.
Yeah. Well, you're carrying the torch here in this book. And I mean, I think a lot of the things that you described, at the way in which you describe Connie Chung, sort of reflect on your own mother. And I wanted to talk about her. You call your mom an accidental immigrant. And what do you mean by that?
Yeah. So my mom had a robust career in China. She was actually an editor of nonfiction books, which explains why I felt very comfortable. And I really, really wanted her to read the book I wrote, even before the chance, like my editor had a chance to read it. But when she came to the United States, she was actually visiting my father, who was in grad school at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln. And she thought this trip was going to last maybe a year, 2 years tops. She put her job on pause, but the idea was that she was always going to come back afterwards and, you know, pick up where she left it. My dad had the same expectations. He would finish out his PhD program, get his degree, and then go back to China. But while he was here, something really big happened, which was the Tiananmen Square student protests. And he joined in a protest in the University of Nebraska, Lincoln, carrying some signs out of solidarity. And if you know anything about those protests, you know, in the first few days of those protests, it started out very peaceful. It was really a student demonstration. And then we all know what happened with it. But his photo was taken and it was printed in a newspaper. And as those protests turned into a real massacre, you know, that photo got sent to his parents by an anonymous person. It was really ambiguous what that even meant, but that threat was fairly clear that someone was paying attention to what he was doing in the United States. And so the American government, in response to that, offered a green card program for Chinese students who were studying abroad in the United States. And my family took advantage of that. And what was supposed to be a year, 2 year trip for my mom ended up being a permanent move. And she still to this day, she's like, I brought one suitcase. She's like, I did not know. And that's when they sent for me. And I came to the United States too.
Well, it's a fascinating story because most immigrants come wanting to be here for a long time and wanting to reestablish a life. But your mom had a real life back home in China that she wanted to return to.
She really did. She had a great job. She had great friends. She loved the things that she loved, which were shopping and eating out and just like being a young woman. We had a big family back at home. So when she found herself in the United States and not able to translate a very big career as an editor of Chinese nonfiction into anything that made sense here, you can imagine just like how much that rocked her sense of identity. And then, of course, I was here and she became pregnant with my little sister, which meant, you know, that's one extra kid than is allowed for under Chinese policy. She knew that it was over and she really had to figure out what life would be like as an American, much less a Chinese American. She had no idea what that meant.
Absolutely. Well, we were talking to author Connie Wang about her new memoir, Oh My Mother. We'll have more after the break.
This is Barbara Leslie, President of the Oakland Port Commission. Oakland International Airport, OAK, is proud to bring you this podcast of KQED's Forum. When you're choosing your next adventure, the smart and convenient choice is to fly the East Bay Way from OAK to destinations across the USA and Mexico. And when you return home, tune in to KQED, always bringing us remarkable stories about who we are and where we live. Enjoy today's episode of Forum.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees, who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Grace Wan, in for Mina Kim. We're talking to journalist Connie Wang about her new memoir, Oh My Mother. It's about the trips she's taken to both physical and emotional places with her mom. Wang is the former executive editor of Refinery 29 and the host of its documentary series, Style Out There. We would love to hear from you, our listeners. I know there's some great stories out there to share. I mean, do Connie Wang's reflections on her name or her experiences with her mom resonate with you? And when was the moment you realized your mom was a person and not just your mom? Email us at email your comments and questions to us at forum@kqed.org or find us on Twitter or Facebook on Instagram at KQED Forum or give us a call now. We're at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Connie, the subtitle of this book is Nine Experiences with My Mother, and those experiences include travel. You've said in interviews that travel helps distill who you are. And there was a moment when your family was able to go back to China. You were a child. And I was curious, what did traveling to China with your mother do to your sense of who she was?
Oh, yeah. You know, it sounds so offensive to say when I finally realized my mom was a person and not just a real mom, but it is so true. And I think that that is a moment that happens in every person's life where you realize your parent isn't just there to take care of you, right? They had a life before you. They will likely have a life after you leave home. So that first trip back to China was monumental, not only because of just the logistics of going there. It was the furthest that I would have ever traveled. Well, I would have remembered traveling, right? Mm-hmm. Out of any of my peers, even, that trip to China was the first time that anyone flew as far as I did. So that made me feel quite proud. But the other thing is, and this is something I didn't realize, it was the first time my parents would have gone back to China since they got stuck here. Mm-hmm. It would have been a homecoming for them in a sense that I would have never been able to grasp as a 10-year-old. And for me, it was a chance to sort of compare myself. And at that age, I think that, you know, that's all you want to do, to kind of see how you stack up around your friends, around people you admire, around people that you don't admire. And I really was in a quite awkward stage of, of adolescence. Just a, you know, very homely looking child, super awkward, not great social skills. Mm-hmm. And what I really desperately wanted out of that trip was not a sense of belonging per se, but a sense of superiority. And that feels so upsetting to say out loud right now, but that is the truth. I wanted to go home, compare myself against my cousins and be like, I'm American. Like they're merely Chinese. Look at how great we are. Look at how great I am. That is not what my parents were thinking, obviously. Certainly not what my mother was thinking. She was so concerned about presenting a version of her life that would make my grandparents and her family members feel like they hadn't made a mistake, that it wasn't a tragic sort of accident that they were in the United States and had gotten stuck here, and that things were actually okay, and they were making do. So superiority wasn't the goal of my mom. But it was a much more modest one, but it was also a much more bittersweet one. And so, of course, like I write about this in the memoir, but when we went back, like I was just horrified to realize that I was so wrong. All my assumptions were wrong. The hometown that we went back to, Jinan and Qingdao in the Shandong province, they're cosmopolitan cities. They're huge. And they just dwarfed where we were living in Eden Prairie, Minnesota, which was a lovely, lovely suburb in Minnesota, but it is not a major metropolitan city. I was shocked to see how well well-liked and well-connected, and how many friends that they had in China, how many people wanted to take them out and catch up, and the ways in which they spoke to my parents were unlike anything I had ever seen before, where, you know, mostly white adults, when they would speak to my parents, would kind of speak to them like they were children, mostly because of their language skills, but they would always speak to them as if there was a distance between them. And that obviously wasn't the case. And you know, my Chinese language skills were drastically diminished by that time. But what I could understand from it all was that, like, I had gotten it wrong, that my parents in America was a maybe diminished version of themselves than my parents in China. Mm. And that was a really upsetting thing to realize while I was in China. Yeah, it was humbling.
I mean, and when your mother comes back from that trip, I mean, before she left, she wasn't much of a clothes hound. And you describe, you know, the baggy T-shirts, sort of the mom wear that she had. And then after that trip, she became more obsessed with her fashion. And I guess, was she finding a new self, or was she just rediscovering her old self?
Well, Grace, this isn't something I realized until I fully became an adult, but my mom had always been super fashionable. I just couldn't see, I couldn't recognize the style in like 80s clothing, right? So when I would see photos of her back in China, I was like, oh my God, this is so tacky. Like not even realizing that, you know, she was actually incredibly fashion forward. But, you know, out of a sort of a necessity of staying like thrifty, also just like dealing with just very like just depression, really. You know, when you're depressed, you really don't want to dress up or draw attention to yourself. But after she came home from, we came back from that homecoming in China, something changed. You know, and I was also at an age too, and I was starting to get into fashion and realizing that the fashion magazines that we had been subscribing to wasn't just like they just checked a checkbox on that sort of like a card that you get in magazines from airline miles and you get free magazines. But she was subscribing to them because she loved fashion. And so we started shopping together. And the things that she would pick out for herself were beyond my expectations. I was like, wow, my mom has a wild sense of style. And the things that she would urge me to try out for myself were also really adventurous, and things that I never thought that moms would ever want their kids to be wearing. And so that was my first inkling that, like, uh-oh, I really don't understand my mom at all. Mm. And I kind of like this discovery that there's something so fascinating about what she's showing me about herself and how we're engaging with this that, you know, if there's anything that is a theme of this book, it's just I'm always wrong about everything, especially when it comes to her.
Well, I looked on your Instagram and I saw the outfit your mother wore to one of your book talks at Vroman's in Pasadena. And all I have to say is thumbs up. I mean, she did a great job. She looked amazing. And she's very stylish. And as you said, she fits in all the sample sizes, too. She must have found it very fulfilling that you became a fashion editor.
She did. Oh, my gosh. She loved it when I was a fashion editor and would receive samples. And a lot of fashion brands at the time would send fashion editors sort of like the most trendy versions of the things that they had made, you know, to ask to be reported on or included in shopping roundups. A lot of those things were not my style. Mm-hmm. And so I passed a lot of those things on to my mom. And so a lot of her wardrobe still consists of, you know, fashion editor samples and things. So looking at her outfits these days, like it's quite a treat because she will mix and match things from different eras. But they're always the trendiest things from every single era. So altogether, it looks completely out of context and a bit bizarre, but that's her style. It's just like it's a cornucopia of insanity.
Well, you know, I was struck by, I mean, I found your mother a really compelling person and character, and she didn't think that a book about her would be very interesting because, in her words, no bad things had happened, just weird ideas. And I'm curious, what are the weird ideas that define your mother or your mother thinks define her?
Yeah, I think a lot of immigrant parents probably have a disaster mindset when it comes to, you know, how life works. But it's true to her, you know, things that she never thought would have happened ended up changing the course of her life. But This also applies to very small things. When my husband and I were looking, we're moving to Los Angeles, and we were thinking about, you know, where we would live. She was like, do not live in a townhouse in Los Angeles because there will be snakes in the walls. And I was like, what are you talking about? You know, of course, it's like one person had told her one anecdote at one time that, you know, that this happened. Never mind where it took place in Arizona, right? The most extreme version of someone's story will lodge into her brain. Mm. And that is the thing that she will, you know, forever apply to those circumstances moving forward. I mean, same goes with nutrition. I think that, like, when it comes to food, my mom has maybe the strangest philosophies about what is constitutes as healthy and good for you. Mm-hmm. For instance, like fruit snacks, like the packaged fruit snacks, not the organic kind, not like the healthy kind, just like the Welch's fruit snacks are the thing you eat when you need to feel better. Like it is like medicine. She gives them to my child and treats it like medicine. And, you know, doctors might not agree, but she stands by it. You know, that is that is a healthy food.
Well, I think I fell in love with your mom when I read that she believes that a drumstick ice cream cone is a perfectly acceptable and nutritious breakfast.
Oh yeah, I know.
Describe that for me. Like, how does that break down?
Well, first of all, now that I'm a parent myself, I kind of understand the allure of a tidy food where you can just like throw away a wrapper at the very end and like that is perfect. At the end of it, it's what you got your carbohydrates in the form of the cone. There's dairy, which is what you eat for breakfast, right? And there's nuts. The nuts are like the real protein of it. It's got chocolate and stuff, but it's like there's also chocolate in breakfast foods. She was like, what is the difference between a drumstick ice cream cone and a bowl of Trix? Honestly, there probably isn't that much.
I believe, first of all, I love a drumstick. And second of all, I hear it. I mean, I think a muffin is basically cake. So, you know, I'm all with your mother. We're talking to journalist Connie Wang about her new memoir, Oh My Mother. It's about the trips she's taken with her mother, both physical and emotional, and the lessons that she's learned from her mom. And we'd love to hear from you. Do Connie Wang's reflections on her name or her experiences with her mom resonate with you? And when was the moment you realized your mom was a person and not just your mom? Email your comments or questions to us at forum@kqed.org or find us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. We're at KQED Forum. Or give us a call. We're at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. This listener writes, I remember the first time my son realized I was a person with a life outside of being a mom. He was 10 and he came home from school and he asked, how was your day? It was weirdly so moving. That's very sweet. Connie, so your parents' trajectory, they slowly gain a foothold into the middle class and they triumphantly joined a timeshare vacation club. You say that those vacations sort of toughened you up to the point where you today are unscammable, and that's a point of pride for you. What did those timeshare vacations represent for you as a child and an older kid growing up?
Yeah. If I'm thinking about all the chapters that I wrote in this book, I think that timeshare chapter was probably the toughest for me, just because of the emotions that I have about this timeshare program are not good ones.
Spoiler alert, this is not an ad for timeshares. Okay, got it.
Yeah. So the timeshare program that they bought into, I'm not going to name the name of it, but it was very, very, very expensive. Like eye-wateringly expensive, and they bought it on a lark in our mall, like from a kiosk, and basically it locked us into this obligation to take a vacation every year, which sounds really nice, but only in the select group of timeshares that they had around the world. When they first did it, I thought, okay, this is amazing. We have never gone on a family vacation before to go like sit around and do nothing. That was such an exotic idea. To, like, go to a beach and just hang out for the entire day. There would be no sort of like tours of museums or college campuses or, you know, the educational moments that of the vacations that we had normally taken. But then the other part of it, because I knew how much money it was, and that never sat right with me from the very beginning. And, you know, I was old enough at that point to realize that, like, you know, there are predatory aspects of this world that really prey on immigrants who have a lot of ambitions and dreams about their own lives, but don't necessarily have the savvy, the cultural sort of competency or the language skills to see the scam within underneath. And as I started going on them, there was a few things that, like, really just didn't sit well with me. The fact that all of the other people at these resorts were, you know, of lower education, oftentimes immigrants with the sort of, like, language skills that my parents had or didn't have. And the other thing was, like, they would always try to upsell you during these very fakely grand breakfasts that were quote unquote free. But they would try to upsell you with these points and these things that you would have to do in order to trade in your points for more access to all these things. It was always so frustrating. I could never express myself during those breakfasts and try to defend ourselves from whatever scam was happening there. And at a certain point to this day, we're still in this timeshare program. Oh. I've just given up my hands. I'm just like, we're not going to go to this breakfast anymore. We're going to get our money's worth. But unfortunately, we're still locked in. We're still going every year.
Well, hopefully you'll pass on that trait of being unscammable to your son as a result. Let's go to the phones. We've got Martin from Santa Clara. Martin, welcome to Forum.
Well, thanks for the call. Yeah, for my mom, I realized that she wasn't just a mom when she was very creative as an artist, was doing paintings, but I could ask her to draw pictures of aircraft. She could just look at a picture and draw whatever I wanted for me. And that was something I knew that other moms never did for their kids or even could do. So I knew then at a young age, probably like 6 or 7 years old, that my mom wasn't just a mom, that she was someone that had a passion for something else beyond just family.
Oh, that's really lovely. Thanks for calling, Martin. I think similarly, Connie, you might have had that revelation working with your mom on this book. As you said, she was a hotshot editor back in China. And watching her edit this book and add detail and her own thoughts to it, did that change how you saw your mom or see your mom today?
100%, Grace. I knew that it was going to not be possible to write this book without her input and without her collaboration, because it would be dishonest to my story if my mom wasn't also involved in telling this story. And I understand a lot of memoirs, especially difficult memoirs about families, are written in isolation because it's a difficult thing to do. And sometimes you don't want input. But for this one, I really wanted to tell a story from her perspective. And, you know, I obviously had to involve her quite deeply. The other aspect of this was it was written during the pandemic. And so, you know, for her to come stay with us was a multi-month sort of affair. Each time we would be together, we would have to stay for a long time just because of what we knew about quarantining back then. So I had the luxury of being able to write chapters and then have her right there and where we would discuss the themes, discuss the sort of scenes that would happen, discuss our memories and where they overlapped and where they differed. And in real time, you know, and then she would be able to see the final product as it was produced. So it was it happened both out of a need. I knew that there was a moral need to involve her, but also just because she was there, she was right next to me.
Well, there are things that she said, nope, that's not going in the book, and that you really wanted in there?
There were a lot of things that did not make it into the book. Some of them were because she thought it was too boring. And honestly, she was probably right. She's an editor, you know? And then other things are, they're family secrets, you know? And I think that is such an important thing to be able to preserve and to keep. The secrets that you have between people and between your family they're sacred. And I, of course, I didn't want to do any of those. Like, I didn't want to reveal any of those things in the book. So there are things that are still private between her and her family and her and me that we'll never write about, you know, and I'll never write about. So, of course, there are things in there. Because those were the reasons, I don't feel bad that they didn't make it into the book, you know.
Well, we're going to talk more to Connie Wang about her new memoir, Oh My Mother, edited by her own mother. And we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call if you have a story about traveling with your parent and what you learned about your parent from those trips. And or are you a child of immigrants? And what does your mother not understand about your life? And what don't you understand about your parents' life as an immigrant? Email your comments and questions to forum@kqed.org, or find us on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram. We're at KQED Forum. Or give us a call now at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. More after the break.
This is Barbara Leslie, President of the Oakland Port Commission. Oakland International Airport, OAK, is proud to bring you this podcast of KQED's Forum. When you're choosing your next adventure, the smart and convenient choice is to fly the East Bay Way from OAK to destinations across the USA and Mexico. And when you return home, tune in to KQED, always bringing us remarkable stories about who we are and where we live. Enjoy today's episode of Forum.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees, who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Grace Wan, in for Mina Kim. We're talking with journalist Connie Wang about her new memoir, Oh My Mother, a memoir in nine adventures. Wang previously worked as executive editor at Refinery 29 and was host of the site's documentary fashion series, Style Out There. Connie, in your book, you devote an entire chapter to your mother's love of the movie Magic Mike XXL. Honestly, I think I laughed out loud through that entire essay. So I'd like to know, from where did your mother's love for this movie spring?
You know, I have no idea. to this day, I'm not quite sure I have my hunches of what spoke to her in the movie. But I think it was just a visceral reaction to the fact that it was a really good time. You know, I think she had seen the first Magic Mike, and it was, it's a completely different type of movie. It's quite depressing. It's very, very dark and slow. It's actually my favorite Magic Mike movie, of course. But the second one is just like a rollicking good time from beginning to end. And I do think that there is one storyline in it with Andy McDowell that really captured my mom's sort of love and attention, in which Andy McDowell talks about how women of her age are oftentimes ignored by people. And I think the Channing Tatum character and all the other magic men in the show tried to prove her wrong in that scene. But she had a deep love for the movie, had seen it in theaters a number of times, and just talked incessantly about just how fun it was and how impressive the dancing was. And so we ended up somehow attending the Magic Mike live show in Las Vegas together, basically on a dare, even though it was an unspoken dare. But that's how it happened. We did it.
Well, you said, Mom, there's this show in Vegas. Do you want to go? I think you didn't believe she would actually take you up on the offer.
Never in my life did I think that she would go see it. I think because of the subject matter of the show, these are, you know, strippers and dancers. And to my knowledge, she has never done anything like that in her life before.
Right.
And the live show would, you know, probably be the most, I mean, not probably, was the most sanitized version of what male reviews probably are. But they're still not something you kind of do with an Asian immigrant mom. But, you know, again, I'm always wrong about her. And so she said yes, and we did it.
Well, you didn't just do it. You ended up on stage. Am I right?
Yeah, I did, unfortunately. you know, what ended up happening is I didn't really think through the importance of outfit choices in things like this. I'm a pants kind of person. I'm not, mm-hmm. I don't really like wear dresses or skirts. And so I naturally just wore a pair of pants. And I think that we wanted to, you know, show up together. And she was like, what do you wear to one of these? I'm like, I'm going to wear these pants. So she ended up wearing pants too. And the thing about Magic Mike and their performances is that, like, they will, if they decide that you are the person they're going to pull up on stage, mm-hmm. they're going to flip you upside down. They're going to twirl you around. And so you should be wearing pants. I had no idea that that was one of the things they look out for. Ah. And so I kind of, I really played myself in this.
Well, I appreciate the fact that you wore pants, your mother wore pants, and your mother came with a $200 worth of $1 bills, like a huge stack of money, because mm-hmm. she was trying to replicate, I guess, the movie experience, and she was prepared to just fly those bills out of her hand, if I understand the story correctly.
Yep. Yeah, we paid for everything with those single dollars after the fact. It was quite the quite the memory. But yeah, no, I got pulled up on stage and, you know, in a quite awkward sequence, at least it was for me. There's video footage of this that my mom took that I've seen a snippet of it, and that's mm-hmm. enough for me. I like do not need to revisit that moment again in my life. But it was, I couldn't see anything. The lights were so bright. I was mortified while it was happening. I was actively willing myself to forget it as I was up on stage. But the one thing I do remember is like, it's her standing up, filming me, her face just like beaming because she was so Aww. Proud. And, you know, that was a really wonderful thing to remember from a truly horrifying experience.
Well, I mean, it's a lesson learned, which is one, never predict what your mom's going to do. And mm-hmm. two, you never know what's going to make a parent proud.
I still don't know what exactly she was proud about, but it's maybe the fact that like I didn't say no. I just did it, and I was a little brave about it and put myself out there.
Yeah. Well, another experience that you had with your mom is you were a fashion editor, and you had a relationship to Paris where mm-hmm. you would attend shows, and it was kind of a part love, part hate feeling about Paris. And then you and your mother went on a trip to Versailles. How did that change your feelings about Paris and France? I mean, you encountered a huge group of Chinese tourists there.
Oh, yeah. So this was a major moment for my mother. She had never traveled outside of North America before, except back home to China. So this was the first time she had ever been to Europe. And at that point, I had been to Europe at least twice a year, and to Paris specifically twice a year for the past however many years as a fashion editor. It felt like a very like mundane sort of old hat moment for me, but realized that this was probably the most exotic thing my mom would have done in her life up until that point. So when we went to Paris, the things that were on our hit list were places that she had remembered reading about in books or seeing in movies, because that's how she really experienced the world, having not gone there. And Versailles was very high on her list. So when we went, she expected the Versailles from cinema, which is, again, Nothing we expect ends up happening that way. Mm-hmm. And what we actually found was that it's a massive tourist destination, as anyone who's ever been to Versailles recently will be able to tell you. But the majority of the tourists we were shocked to see were Chinese tourists from mainland China. And the reason we were shocked is because up until, I would want to say, a decade prior to that, mainland Chinese tourists were not traveling the world like that because of national policies, just access, the ability to even secure visas. But at a certain time, the gates opened and Chinese tourists really took advantage of this newfound freedom. And they began traveling in huge numbers en masse and typically through these tour buses, which make traveling to foreign countries where you don't speak the language, don't know the culture, don't kind of know how to behave and the local etiquette a lot more friendly to them. Mm. And so when we got to Versailles, we accidentally made a wrong turn, ended up in the parking lot for these giant tour buses. And we're surrounded by Chinese tourists. And it was a real moment for both of us. I had never been around that many mainland Chinese people outside of China, mm-hmm. And just seeing how they behaved, juxtaposed against how American tourists behaved, and then juxtaposed against how we were behaving too. I was like, this is just like an amazing culture clash that I found really, really meaningful, and she did too.
And what did you find meaningful about that? Because is it because the Chinese tourists, maybe the best way to say it, they just didn't care. They were Chinese tourists and they didn't care what other people thought about them. And perhaps you and your mom were a little bit more clipped in your way that you move through the world as Chinese Americans?
Yeah, Grace, that's basically it. You know, as Asian Americans, when we are in public, the most important thing that we're trying to do is to not be noticed and not kind of stick our heads out. And that's just how I think a lot of minorities move through this world. But we at Versailles, I think we were also there with the sort of pressure of not doing the ugly American sort of like tourist thing and not falling into those stereotypes, of which we likely wouldn't have, just because our personalities aren't that way. Mm-hmm. But we do see, and we have seen, and both of us were very familiar with sort of like the ugly Western, like the tourist stereotype. But then seeing how Chinese people were traveling, I want to say all, but quite a lot of them, they were traveling with very little regard for what is appropriate in that local setting. They were traveling like what I imagine ugly Americans travel like, but in a completely different way. But if you know anything about Versailles, you also know that like the etiquette of Versailles, while there were very formal rules, it was also just completely rude, quite disgusting sometimes, just ostentatious, over the top, and totally ego driven. Mm-hmm. And if there's any place to exhibit those behaviors as a tourist, it might be Versailles.
Well, we have a listener comment who writes, "My mom is a registered nurse, and during the pandemic, I saw her work more than she had when I was young, even though she's hoping to retire soon. She volunteered for extra long shifts and to work on her days off. It was equally inspiring and sad because after years of work, she's still working so hard." Do you feel that with your own mom, that, you know, she gave up a lot to come to the United States, and she wasn't, as we've said, one of those immigrants who wanted to be here? Was there a bit of guilt for you as you wrote this book to reconcile with?
Yeah, there absolutely was. I did not think about the loss of career for her until I was writing this. And that feels like a very, very, you know, childlike thing to say. I'm a person in my mid-30s, I'm sad to say it took me until then to really understand the loss that she experienced in her early 20s. As someone, too, who's very proud of the career that they've established and very grateful for the ability to find my own career, you know, I didn't ever feel a pressure to follow in certain paths or do certain things that were outside of my own desires. But for my mother, the hard and difficult decision to enter back into the workforce in an industry that she wasn't entirely passionate about, but was really driven by what she could do without a very strong grasp of language, and then what she made out of it, which is that she's been at the same company now and working as an accountant for 20 years. She's made wonderful friends, lifelong friends, some of whom actually came out to go see her during our book talk in Pasadena at Romans, which was so fun to see. And she says she loves her job and she loves work. And she is nearing retirement age. But every single morning when she gets up to go to work, she loves it. And she dresses up to go to the office. And she has, you know, she takes a photo every single day before she goes. And I think that feeling of being useful, having a community that is outside of a friend group or even a family, feeling like plugged into industry was really, really important for her. And also, you know, the being able to find the silver lining in any situation is one of my mom's superpowers. And she's turned that silver lining into something really, really glittery and big.
Well, this is Forum. I'm Grace Wan in for Mina Kim. I sort of love that your mom has an outfit of the day situation happening.
She says she's never repeated an outfit since the pandemic. And I think I believe her.
That is really impressive. I'm sure she never went to the sweats and elastic waistband alternatives in her wardrobe.
She had her own version of that. It wasn't what I looked like, that's for sure.
Well, you have a young child and it was born during the pandemic. And I think becoming a parent often changes how we see our own parents. Was that your experience with your mom after your child was born?
How could it not be my experience? Being a parent, it breaks your brain. It breaks your body too, in the best of ways. It completely flattens every sort of assumption and idea that you've had about how things ought to be and how things are, and builds it up from the ground up, which is a really excruciating and beautiful and rewarding process if you choose to do it and you want to do it. But I think the main thing that I've experienced from now being a parent myself and raising my little son, Mark, is the importance of always trying to understand one another. Mm-hmm. You know, he's just starting to talk and he's a chatterbox and it is so fun to watch him try to express himself in really creative ways. And he does it with my mother in Chinese and he does it with me in Chinese and English and my husband in English. And that constant sort of effort that he puts into it and the effort that I also put into it, it really reinforced the idea that even though my mother and I, we cannot understand each other in a language basis, mm-hmm. as well as someone like my husband and his mother can understand each other because they both speak fluent English, right? Mm-hmm. But that's no excuse for not trying to understand each other. We can always improve. We can always get better. And in fact, the fact that my mother and I, we don't speak, our dominant languages are not the same language. It's actually, I do see a silver lining in this, and that the assumption is we always have to try and we always have to get better at it. And that sort of always striving to get to understand each other is a real gift that my mother and I share.
Well, Jamie writes, I love this segment. Thank you, Connie. For moms of young girls who want our kids to see us as people with our own lives, wants, and experiences, any tips for better facilitating that realization? Sometimes it seems like you and your mom tapped into something special in that regard.
Yeah. So my kid is so young at this point that I actually feel like I should be asking you for advice in this. But I think that one thing that has been really great is that my mom has leaned into hobbies and things that give her a lot of pleasure in a very selfish sort of way. And I say that in a very good sense, you know, and knowing what my mom's predilections are and her preferences are and how she likes to spend her free time and where she carves out and demands the room to do it, even if it might be annoying to other people or time consuming for other people, is so important. And, you know, the moms oftentimes are the ones who sacrifice the most in a family, mm-hmm. in demanding time to be selfish and do things that speak only to yourself, and making sure your kids understand that, I think, is really important. Mm-hmm. And you know, if you're lucky, your kids also find joy in those pursuits as well, and you guys can do them together. So for my mom, that was shopping, and thank goodness I love shopping, so I'll do it with her. But there are things that help you understand, oh, she knows something so much better than I do in this one area, and I can learn from her about that in almost like a friend to friend level rather than a mom to child level. And that opens up a lot of doors.
Well, we have just about a minute left, and I just wanted to reflect on one other aspect of the book. You and your mom have a fight, and your mother expresses probably one of the more honest statements I've heard about parenting, in which she basically says, I don't belong to anyone. I belong to no one. Well, in the time that we have left, what did she mean by that, and how did that impact you?
Yeah, I think about this thing that she said every single day of my life. The idea of being beholden to people out of our choice, and not only just people, but beholden to an idea, to a country, to a situation, and feeling trapped in that is a lot of people's worst nightmares. Mm-hmm. And so much about her life is about being trapped and breaking free from that trap, whether it's her own body. Sometimes her health issues have made her feel trapped in her own body. Mm-hmm. The idea of being accidentally stuck in America, yeah. The liberation and being able to choose your own destiny and choose your own adventure is so important to her. It's one of her triggers to feel trapped. So being able to indulge in that, to set up a life in which you do feel liberated and do feel free, and to also make that happen for other people, is really the story of her life. And I'd love for that to be the story of my life too.
Oh, it's so wonderful. And it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. We've been talking to journalist Connie Wang about her new book, Oh My Mother. It's a winner. Pick it up from an independent bookstore near you. Thanks so much for joining us, Connie.
Thanks, Grace. This was fun.
Yeah. We're going to take you out with a cut from Magic Mike XXL soundtrack. I mean, who doesn't love a little Backstreet Boys? This Hour of Form is produced by Caroline Smith, Juan Carlos Lara, and me, Grace Wan. Marlena Jackson-Rotondo is our engagement producer. Susie Britton is our lead producer. Our engineers are Danny Bringer, Brendan Willard, and Christopher Beal. Our interns are Lulu Ralda and Jericho Reininger. Our vice president of news is Ethan Tovin-Lindsay, and our chief content officer is Holly Kernan. Have a safe and wonderful Memorial Day weekend, everyone, and hug your mom.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising Simons Foundation.
This is Barbara Leslie, President of the Oakland Port Commission. Oakland International Airport, OAK, is proud to bring you this podcast of KQED's Forum. When you're choosing your next adventure, the smart and convenient choice is to fly the East Bay Way, from OAK to destinations across the USA and Mexico. And when you return home, tune in to KQED, always bringing us remarkable stories about who we are and where we live. Enjoy today's episode of Forum.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.